One Butte County survivor of the campfire shares his story of remaining at home when most in his community evacuated. Hear what motivated him to confront the firestorm. Also, a UC Davis doctor says mass shootings like the recent tragedy in Thousand Oaks are largely preventable if two policies that exist today could be properly used. Thanksgiving is 1 week from tomorrow. If you're serving wine, you'll want to hear our conversation with wine expert Rick Cushman. And we'll be treated to a live performance from blues artist Katie Nipp. I'm Randall White, in for Beth Ruyak this week. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Randall White, in for Beth Ruyak today. CAL FIRE continues to make gains against the Camp wildfire burning in Butte County. Thousands, however, remain evacuated as the town of Paradise and surrounding communities were incinerated in a firestorm last week. Not everyone evacuated when strong winds pushed that fire into a rapidly spreading inferno. Some, tragically, were trapped or simply couldn't leave their homes for various reasons. Others, like our next guest, chose to stay behind, and in this case, had set up a plan to do so years in advance. Joining us to talk about how he and his wife, Kathy, survived the firestorm is Dr. Douglas Houston. He's the chancellor of the Yuba Community College District. Dr. Houston, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
And we should mention, you're calling from, or we're talking to you from within the fire zone right now. You're on a cell phone?
That's correct, yeah. I'm at my home inside what is called the Lower Neal Road Zone, south of Paradise.
Tell us about the moment when that fire moved onto your property. What was going through your mind?
A lot of planning still. I was trying to assess how the fire was coming in and sort of delegate out tasks to my wife and I as to how we would fight it as it came in. We weren't sure until it got real close exactly how, whether it would come up a canyon that's to the east of our home or straight down the ridge line to the north of our home. Or a little canyon off to the west, and as I was able to monitor it coming in, then we were able to kind of deploy our resources. So mostly, I think, just thinking and planning, not any real time other than that to react to it.
To be afraid, and this is not something that you just decided on the spur of a moment.
No, we're going to stay behind.
No, you've been planning for years.
No. Well, we've lived in this house for 20 years. We've known since we bought this property and moved out here that we were pretty isolated. We knew that if a fire like this came in, that we would have to be the lowest priority for the firefighting resources. We knew that. So we've been preparing. We've cleared acres around our house. We have ample water storage, a generator. We own our own fire pumps. We own our own fire-resistant clothing, tools, and smoke masks. You know, we'd given this a lot of thought, and I knew as this fire came in, I knew that the absolute safest place for us would actually to be here rather than trying to evacuate.
And because you and your wife, Kathy, did stay behind, you didn't just take care of your own home, but you helped out neighbors as well.
Yeah, well, as the next day, we fought the fire really till about 2 or 3 in the morning, fighting spot fires around our house and several homes to the south of us. And then the next day, we went out to survey the damage on our road. We're on about 2 miles of private road south of Paradise, and probably about 2 dozen homes along in here. And that's when we started gathering up our neighbors' livestock and penning them up, horses, goats. Even found a neighbor's pig and lots of chickens. We have lots of chickens out here on our ridge. And so we've just now what we've been doing is staying in touch with our neighbors, taking care of their animals, patrolling their homes, locking things up if they need us to, keeping them apprised of the status of their properties.
So being within the fire zone and being there the entire time and having access to the news and that sort of thing, is there anything that you're hearing in reports that doesn't match up with what you experienced firsthand?
No. Now we certainly were not in the town of Paradise, and we've only barely ventured up into it. What little we've seen certainly matches all of the pictures and descriptions that we've seen on the internet. On our ridge, we probably lost maybe half of the homes, which is nothing compared to what actually occurred up in town. I would say that we're really pleased that the law enforcement and the first responders have been able to stay focused up in Paradise. We haven't seen much of them, but we didn't want and didn't expect that they would need to take the time to come down our way. Those that we've interacted with have just been fabulous, and we've been thrilled to chat with law enforcement, firefighters from all over the state, and just really proud of how hard they're working to support everybody up here.
The opportunities you have taken to venture out and observe some of the damage, what's it like for you living up there as long as you have? Is it eerie to see it in its current condition?
Yeah, it's, I'll say this as a combat veteran, so I can't say this lightly. It really does look like, you hear the phrase war zone. It's easy to take that lightly, but it does really look like that. And the hard part, of course, is that even those areas that we've driven, we know people whose homes now have been destroyed. We've been able to contact them. In some cases, we brought them the first news. Often they already knew. Our church was a pretty iconic picture of our church burning on the first day. So our entire congregation is now down in Chico. Those that are accounted for, we're starting to learn that some of our members may not have survived. And so that's hard. These are people that we've known for decades, friends. I would say certainly eerie, disheartening. Frustrating. It's very sad, obviously. I think there's also some hope. Many of our neighbors have other family members that live up in town who lost homes, and they've been able to get out to see us as we've rescued their animals. And I think they're starting to develop a sense of hope as well, sort of coming out of the initial shock and thinking about how they'll go about rebuilding and redoubling their commitment to do so.
And are you hearing that most people will rebuild, that this is a place where they've called it their home and they want to continue to do that?
Yes, in general. We're hearing stories of people, even potentially some of our own congregation members who are elderly and might just choose to relocate to live with family in some other part of the state or some other state. But most of the people that we've spoken with have just absolutely committed to staying. To a person, they've all said that they just really love this town of ours, and they want to be part of its future.
You and Kathy survived the Humboldt Fire, which affected Paradise, a decade ago. Was that the impetus for you preparing so well for this next one?
I would say it's certainly, we learned a lot of lessons from it, and we redoubled our efforts. So we had already cleared several acres around our house, and we had one pump and a small generator at the time. We successfully defended our property then. That fire actually caused more harm on our road than this fire did. But we collected our lessons learned after that, and we installed a larger generator, which is running our house now. I bought a second fire pump. And then probably the biggest investment for us was there was a vacant and undeveloped parcel to the north of us that I knew was the greatest risk. After the Humboldt Fire, we had put out spot fires and dropped burning trees for really almost a week on that property. And 2 years ago, we were blessed to be able to just purchase it. And we've been clearing it ever since. We've probably cleared about a third of it, all heading north from our house. And so when this fire came in, and it came in right along that ridge, it stopped pretty much dead at the point where we had stopped clearing. And so what that left us with was all we had to do was fight the embers that were flying in from the fire. And that was something that was managed at that point. So, yes, I would say the Humboldt Fire especially was just, it reinforced some lessons, and it gave us some new ones, and it redoubled our commitment to being better prepared.
You were just
had a number of fire officials come out over the years, look at our place and say that, the word they would shelter in place as well. They felt that we just we were well defended.
So with the amount of defensible space that you have around your house, I imagine not everyone can do that. They don't have the expansive property that you do. And how do you, how do you deal with shade in the summer? There's no trees right there, right?
Well, no, actually, we have strategically located trees to the west, and we use some passive systems to the east and south. We have awnings and called shade sails, those kinds of things, which we dropped Thursday morning as very early on as the fire just started to grow. Our first step was to drop all of those, get them out of the way, and then from there to deploy the rest of our resources. So, but no, you're right. We're really fortunate to have as much space that we have control over to be able to clear it the way that we have. And really, as a consequence, then the three houses to the south of us were also pretty shielded from the fire. All of us have cleared. The Humboldt Fire, I think, taught this entire little neighborhood the importance of keeping properties cleared. And when folks rebuilt after the Humboldt Fire, they just didn't allow things to grow other than very strategically planted trees. And no ladder fuel to speak of.
We're speaking with Yuba Community College District Chancellor Dr. Douglas Houston about surviving the campfire at his home. He and his wife, Kathy, prepared their property in Paradise by keeping defensible space and buying firefighting equipment. They stayed behind as the fire burned homes around theirs, successfully defending their own house. And Doctor, I have to ask you, as the leader of a community college, a lot of people look up to you. Do you feel that staying behind when an evacuation was ordered sets a good example?
I do, especially, but only under our circumstances. So I'm still able to support my college district, I'm able to work in ways that I probably wouldn't have been able to had we evacuated. But our assessment was based on our own circumstances. Everyone has to make that choice for themselves. We knew we'd had affirmed from, as I said, numerous fire officials that we were well prepared. Certainly anyone who doesn't have that that opportunity, who hasn't been able to prepare to the depth and expense that we have, should heed the evacuation warnings certainly heed the evacuation orders. But I think under the circumstance, I think really that if there's leadership that we've shown through this, it's been in our preparation, in our anticipation of this, and in not wanting to add to the burden of the first responders as they're trying to support those who didn't have the means to prepare in ways that we did.
Even with all of your planning, if the fire had reached a point where you realized it was a losing battle, did you have an escape route available to you?
Yeah, we had several alternate plans. Actually, we had our cars loaded, all of our animals in kennels in a box trailer, all out on our pasture, which is eaten down to dirt. And I think probably no way that we would have had to worry about losing the vehicles. There's at least one route that I know out of here. I'd probably be cutting some people's fences and gates to get out. We knew that we have some walking trails that we, if we have to. We also have a swimming pool, and so we had several strategies. We thought we could also just hunker down in the pool. There's really no trees around it to speak of, and even if the house went, then we'd still be fine. So we had worked out several alternative strategies as well. We've been thinking about this for a long time.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Yeah. We hear about the shrinking rainy season in California and the warmer temperatures. And then, of course, more people moving into what were previously wildland settings. Do you think the risks of living in these wildland urban interface areas has gotten worse, or has it always been a possibility that this could happen?
I think it's always been a possibility. When we first moved up here and moved to this specific site, we did a lot of research. Neither my wife nor I are originally from California. We met in Southern California. So when we moved up here, we started doing some research. I think the danger has always been with us. But I do agree. I think it's exacerbated because more and more people are choosing this lifestyle. Other than days like today, we have stunning views. We have wonderful neighbors that we know well. We live in a pretty secluded lifestyle, so it's quiet, and it's the lifestyle that we choose. But it does mean that we're now putting ourselves at greater risk. We're farther away from public services and the like. So those are choices that we made. But I think your point is a good one. More and more people are choosing to do so. And so you'd acknowledged earlier that I'm an educator. Some of my colleagues and I around the state are already starting to put together some ideas for how public education, higher education, can contribute to the education of people that choose to live in these environs. I mean, it's, you know, more and more people are choosing the rural lifestyle for their family's sake. But it does mean that now we need to start to find some education solutions that they might not otherwise have access to. How to work as a neighborhood to prepare, those kinds of things.
Doctor, do you think fire safety should be a required class at the community college level?
Oh, what an interesting idea. You just put a bug in my... I'd not given that a whole lot of thought. I was really thinking more in terms of the kind of education and outreach that we provide in our communities. You know, our education goes beyond just what we do in our classrooms with our students. We're community colleges especially are leaders in their in the rural communities. We're the only institutions of higher education. And so our communities really look to us to be those kinds of education and providers and leaders. And I think it's an opportunity for us to really step up our game. And I know that my colleague here at Butte College, Samia Yacoub, the president, her college is now recovering in ways that my own colleges have had to struggle during the fires in Lake Camp at Lake County, or colleges in Santa Rosa and Redding and Napa areas, and now Ventura. And we're all comparing notes as to what we can be doing, not just to support our students and our employees, that's a first priority, but then what we can be doing to support our communities.
Before we let you go, you're the first person we've had an opportunity to speak with who is physically in the fire zone as we speak with them. What can you see from your home right now? It sounds like you're on a hillside.
We're on a ridge that overlooks the ordinarily. What can I see? Smoke.
Yeah.
Ordinarily, we look out over the North Sacramento Valley. We're about 2 miles south of the southern edge of Paradise. So we really don't see the town of Paradise ordinarily anyway.
I wasn't sure how thick the smoke is still up there. A lot of it's moved into the Bay Area and the Sacramento Valley. I wasn't sure if at the fire site, maybe it was going straight up and then shooting off, you know, to these other areas. But it sounds like it's still really thick where you are.
Yeah, it has been really since the day after the fire. The air quality's been pretty poor. Smoke's very thick. Our visibility is probably down to a quarter of a mile at the most. Well, actually, I'm going to say less than that because I can't see a ridge that's a quarter of a mile away from me right now.
Oh, wow. Well, the team at Insight and here at Capital Public Radio certainly wish you and your wife and your neighbors, the community up there, the very best in this period of recovery. And thank you so much for spending time with us this morning.
Oh, you're welcome. And my thanks to you and everyone else that's just pouring out all of their time and talent to try and provide support for everyone who's been displaced and for those that are still within this the evacuation zones. Thank you.
Yuba Community College District Chancellor Dr. Douglas Houston, thanks again for being on Insight. And we'll have more information on our website at capradio.org/insight. All the wildfire information you need is at capradio.org/wildfire. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio, your NPR station. You are listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak today. Deadly mass shootings like the recent killings in Thousand Oaks are preventable, according to our next guest. His new research out of UC Davis delves into this theory, saying there are already two policies out there that, if properly used, could reduce, if not stop, future mass shooting incidents. Dr. Garen Wintemute is considered one of the top experts in this field of study. And Dr. Wintemute, welcome to Insight. Nice to have you here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with your premise that there are already policies available that could be used more efficiently. What are they? Let's go down those.
Sure. Let's start with gun violence restraining orders. which allow, in extreme circumstances, firearms to be recovered from somebody at a time of crisis. It's a law that was put into place after a mass murder in Isla Vista, which probably could have been prevented. Gun violence restraining orders have been available in California for a couple of years. We're doing an evaluation, and as part of that, I am aware of two mass shootings in California that did not occur because gun violence restraining orders were used to prevent shooters from acquiring the firearms they were going to use in events that they had threatened to commit.
And these restraining orders vary from state to state. Is there any restraining order on a federal level?
There is not. Legislation's been introduced. It's gone nowhere. I suspect that it will go somewhere if it's reintroduced next year.
And your second measure that you believe could be used more efficiently?
Background checks. We look at the negative here. There are at least two mass shootings, not in California, that occurred because background checks were improperly done or were done on incomplete data. One huge problem, it's turned out, is that the data background checks are run on are incomplete. There are tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands, of prohibiting events that are not in the data. So people who are prohibited clear the background check because the information on their prohibition is not available.
Do these also vary from state to state, and is there a federal requirement?
Well, there is a federal requirement for a background check if the sale is done through a licensed retailer only, and direct private party sales are not subject. In California and a number of other states, that policy has been broadened. We require a background check for essentially all sales of firearms in California.
Does California have the strictest rules when it comes to gun purchases?
That's a hard question to answer. On paper, we have a very assertive regulatory regime. Other states do too. But what's on paper isn't what's actually done. I happen to think that enforcement is also, in general, very strong here in California. I don't see a lot of value in rank ordering states according to the details of their policies.
But the policies themselves, if a state has those policies in place and they are enforcing it, is there evidence to show that it works?
Yes, it varies from policy to policy, but let me give you a California example. A number of years ago, we broadened our denial criteria to prohibit people who'd been convicted of violent misdemeanor crimes from purchasing firearms. And our group did a study of that, in essence, policy experiment, and found that at the individual level, that new policy reduced risk of future violence among the people who were directly affected by 25% to 30%, which is a huge difference. And there have been studies in other states suggesting that GVROs are also very effective.
How do people get access to guns in states where background checks are required, yet they may have something in their backgrounds that would prevent them from owning a gun?
So if we're talking about a state where a background check is required pretty much all the time, there is an illegal market, and some people use that. To be honest, the more common situation is states have not gone beyond federal law, and background checks are required only when the sale is by a licensed retailer. But there's a parallel legal market in which the sellers are private individuals. And in those states, a person who has no criminal intent and is not prohibited can just arrange to buy a firearm. I've photographed hundreds of these transactions. They can take less than a minute. But if the buyer is either a prohibited person or has criminal intent and doesn't want a record, that's really the only option for them. These are purchases that are anonymous. They are undocumented. The firearms are not traceable, and it's legal.
Doesn't this lead into the argument that you hear from gun rights advocates that if guns are outlawed, then only criminals will own guns?
Well, first off, the policy that background checks be required for all firearm transfers is supported by more than 80% of gun owners and more than 70% of self-identified NRA members. So yeah, there's a fringe. But to give that point of view its due, yes, there is an illegal market, but that's what we have cops for. And undercover operations and so on. Firearm violence is a big and complicated health and social problem, and we need a lot of solutions implemented all at once to deal with it.
Let's talk a little bit about high-capacity magazines,
sure,
which hold, the definition is what, more than 10 rounds
That's
of
correct.
Ammunition? A recent state law banning their possession has been put on hold by an injunction. Would that law make, in your mind, California safer if it's allowed to move forward?
I would be really interested if that law gets implemented. We have this problem. There are, my guess is, millions, certainly tens of thousands, of those magazines already in the state. The law that is on hold would ban possession of those magazines. There's no mechanism in place to recover those magazines. So at least at this moment, it's not clear to me that the prevalence of those magazines in the population would decrease. And we've outlawed commerce in those magazines for more than 20 years. So the reason I hesitated when you asked the question is, as a researcher, what I would like to do is, if that law goes into effect, see what happens. My hypothesis would be that having the law actually in force on the books would make a difference, but I would be in what we call equipoise, unsure of what the outcome would be. That's part of the fun of science, to be honest, is we walk in saying, we don't know, let's find out.
The whole point of research, right?
Exactly right.
We're speaking with Dr. Garen Wintemute of UC Davis. He's an expert on the public health effects of gun violence. His new research is about how to stop mass shootings and was recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine. So undoubtedly, you've seen the social media debate about whether doctors should even be at the table for firearm policy discussions. Gun rights advocates say doctors should stay in their lane, is the expression. What's your take about the role physicians and researchers should play? You have personal experience with this, do you not?
I was going to say, I have 35 years as a physician. I'm a practicing ER doc, and that's what got me into doing the science. So obviously, my career is testimony to my belief that doctors have a role to play here. Fortunately, I now have a whole lot of company. What happened was the American College of Physicians, which is the Association of Internal Medicine Doctors in the United States, which has really taken a leadership role here for a while, published a very detailed set of recommendations for its members based on very detailed review of the evidence. Here's what we think doctors ought to do. And we've been working with that organization and published a number of articles in their journal, kind of fleshing out, and here's how to go about talking to your patients and when you might want to and so on. So that policy paper comes out. And the NRA tweets, as you mentioned, that doctors should basically, they're a bunch of know-nothing do-gooders and they ought to keep their minds on their own narrow scope of work. They kicked a hornet's nest. And what we have seen from trauma surgeons and ER docs and internists and others is the response has been basically, excuse me, let me show you the blood in the room after we've, let me show you the chair in which I sit and tell mothers that their children have been shot and killed. This is my lane. Actually, one trauma surgeon talked about how often she did this and said, this isn't just my lane, this is my effing highway, to quote her tweet. Part of what makes me really optimistic about this development is there's clearly been a lot of pent-up demand on the part of physicians. They are off the sidelines. They're getting involved. And as I mentioned, a group of us have been developing infrastructure for more than a year so that as they say, I want to do something, here are the materials showing you how to do it. Here are handouts for your patients. All of this stuff is up on the web already.
Finally, your center is state-funded at UC Davis. But many researchers struggle to acquire the money needed to explore the role of firearms in public health. Was it tough for your program to get the funding?
We spent 25 years struggling. There still is some federal money for research, not from CDC, but it comes from the National Institute of Justice. For a while, it came from the National Institutes of Health. I don't know that there will be an increase in federal funding next year, but there are other states looking at stepping up to fill the gap. There are a few private foundations that have been involved for a long time, and several others have come online in recent years, and still more are making plans to jump in the near future. So I think we're going to see an increase in research funding. I don't know if we'll see any of that increase from the federal government.
All right, gun violence expert Dr. Garen Wintemute of UC Davis, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on Insight.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we, of course, will have links to that study on our website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Cap Radio Insight here on your NPR station. Well, hey there. This is Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in today for Beth Ruyak. You know, the holidays are coming up fast. In fact, what, a week from tomorrow is Thanksgiving. Wine expert Rick Cushman spoke with Beth Ruyak about picking the perfect bottle for your next big gathering.
When I was writing my first book, it was replaying on cable.
The movie Sideways.
Yeah, and my first book was about wine. And I found myself like late at night and watching over and over and over and thinking, I don't want to say what these people are saying.
In the movie, they are glorifying and celebrating the scene about celebrating Pinot in particular, when he describes the love of his life being this certain type of wine.
Yeah, and he does a great job of describing the grape and why it's why they call it the heartbreak grape, you know, because it is a really difficult grape to grow. It has a very thin skin. It needs coolness. Otherwise, if too much sun, it'll get sunburned, but it needs some sun to get ripe. It needs coolness to keep a level of crispness to it so that the flavors come out. But there's also there's a silkiness to it and an earthiness, and it's a really perfumey grape, and it's just, I say it is like, it's like the sexiest grape. I really love it. Funny thing about Sideways, by the way, you know, Sideways did actually help the sales of Pinot Noir.
And I believe it.
And it hurt the sales of Merlot. You know, it's that scene where I'm not drinking any effing Merlot. But Merlot was having issues at its time, but Merlot still vastly outsells Pinot Noir.
Oh, does it?
Vastly. It was the most grown red grape in the world. Now it's Cabernet, but Merlot's right behind for lots of good reason. Actually, the truth of it is there's a lot of really great Merlots out there too. There's so much about Pinot that makes it interesting too. Like, one of the things is it mutates like crazy.
Hmm.
It's a really sort of a genetically unstable grape. So there's all these different clones of it. So you get all these different flavors. And for wine lovers who know, they start to talk about the clone and the place in Burgundy, France, where it's grown. Each clone might need a different treatment and have a different flavors to it. It's given birth to some other grapes like Pinot Gris, which is Pinot Noir basically means black Pinot.
Yes.
And so Pinot Gris, gray, Pinot Blanc, white, Pinot Meunier. I don't know what Meunier means, actually, but that's a red grape. It's the parent of Chardonnay, one of the parents of Chardonnay. So Pinot Noir and a grape we call Gouet Blanc, which sounds like the name of a snail. but those two grapes got together. They, you know, it was a wild Saturday night. Next thing you know, Chardonnay was born, or some version of that. But it's a really impactful grape, and it's very different from so many other types of red wines that are either more stable or more consistent sometimes. That mutationness in all of those different forms of it means that you can get very light Pinots to really heavy, hearty Pinots, you know, all within its own special character.
I think of the Russian River area.
Yeah, one of the great
having
ones.
So many different, not only vineyards, but flavors. And there can be such variation. I thought it was more of a climate issue. But what you're explaining is that maybe it's about the grape or the grape mutation.
Well, it's many of those things all tied together. So some of the different clones need one kind of climate. But certainly the climate has an impact. I mean, if there's anything that has an impact on grapes other than when they pick, it's always something to know. If you know that a grape comes from a cooler climate, it'll be a little lighter, a little brighter, you know, a little bit more snap in it, like an acid to it. But, you know, you don't taste the acid. It just has a sharpness. If it's a little warmer, it'll be a little richer, a little rounder. And so Pinot Noir is absolutely affected by that more than maybe any other grape because it is so sensitive to its climate and to its terroir.
While we've been talking, I looked up Meunier,
uh-huh.
and it just means to grind, to mill. So it's not so much a taste, but maybe a process, but it's an old French word.
Interesting. Well, here's another fun thing about Pinot Meunier, which is an offshoot of Pinot Noir. Actually, all those grapes that I named, Pinot Blanc, Gris, Meunier.
Maybe it's a blend.
They all have the same DNA character. They actually all show up as Pinot Noir. And think about Pinot Meunier. There are times, this is the only grape that we know that does this. There are times where, we've talked once before that you get the color from the skins, right?
Yes.
But because there's so much going on in the DNA that sometimes Pinot Meunier can look, turn very, very light and look almost like a white wine.
Hmm.
It's a blending grape, by the way, in Champagne.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, the main blending grapes in French-style Chardonnay.
So Thanksgiving meal or celebration is a great time to do a little experimenting with Pinot Noir.
Absolutely. Here I am about to contradict everything I always say, but that's pretty much how I roll, which is if you're going to pick one wine to go with your Thanksgiving table and your holiday tables, Pinot Noir, because it just matches. It's a great food wine. The layers of flavor, just it's a little bit of snap, it's lushness, you know, or silkiness. It goes with so many kinds of food. And you think about the kind of earthy foods that are often around in fall and for Thanksgiving and that sort of stuff. It's a great Thanksgiving wine, but in part because it's also just a good wine, you know, so your world isn't too complicated. It's a good wine to sip before the meal and then a wine to sip during the meal, too.
One more note about Thanksgiving dinner, and that is about the glassware.
One of the things that you've heard me say this over and over about not being a wine snob, if there's any time of year to not be a wine snob, the holidays is a time to not you know what about the wine you drink. Just drink whatever's there, enjoy it. Any wine that you like will go with the foods. If you're throwing a party, this is always kind of an issue, right? You know, if you're the one that's hosting Thanksgiving and you've got 20 people coming over, which seems to be the thing. Who has 20 of the same wine glasses besides me because I do events, right? And so don't worry about it. Don't worry about the glasses being different. But I do have a suggestion. And one way, there's only going to be three people there who care. Everybody else, they don't care what the glass is. But there's going to be the one wine snob who's not going to act like a snob because they're listening to our advice, but still going to care about the glass. So what you do is set them out. Don't set them on the table. Set them out and during the appetizers where they're pouring themselves a glass of wine. And what will happen is they will self-select. The people who care will grab the nice glasses. And the people who don't care will just take whatever glasses in front of them and everybody will be happy.
Or the people who plan to drink more or less.
Yes, I go for the big one. That's what I do. Just the largest glass possible so it hides the volume that I'm drinking.
When I think of you at Thanksgiving, I know you love dessert. And that brings us to our final tip.
We've had our pie discussion, haven't we?
We have. There are always at least three different choices of pie
yes.
at the Cushman family dessert
yeah, that's
table.
True. Cherry and pumpkin have to be in there. And then it could be blueberry, lemon meringue. Do you like rhubarb pie? There's really not many. Pie is my happy word. But, and I'm going to tee you up for this one.
Okay.
We have wine advice on the wine that you should choose with your dessert. What kind of wine should that be, Beth?
Just make sure that your wine is sweeter than your dessert.
Yay!
Right?
We say this all the time.
Yeah.
This is the thing I always say about wine, and don't to never forget, is that wine has a little bit of acid in it, any wine. And the example I always use is think about orange juice. You wouldn't think about it having acid until you brush your teeth and have your glass of orange juice, and it's, wow, where's that come from? So wine has that as a backbone. And so the sweetness is just like brushing your teeth. Even though we sort of pretend that it's all fine, if you have a big red wine or even a rich white wine, often with a dessert, the acid is going to come out and the wine will taste sour. Sweet wines, however, and there's nothing wrong with sweet wines, aren't they great? They're sweet and they're wine. But they really enhance the dessert. You'll get all the fruit out of the wine and it'll really make the flavors in your pies really make them pop.
All right, Rick, happy entrance into the holiday season.
I'm excited already for my pie.
Wine expert Rick Cushman speaking with Beth Ruyak about picking that perfect bottle of wine for your next big gathering, likely Thanksgiving. More information on our website at capradio.org/insight. And you are listening to Insight right here on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Well, when I go back to Santa Cruz. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak. Blues musician Katie Knipp is riding pretty high this morning. Her new album, Take It With You, released, it was a week ago today, right?
Yeah.
Just popped into Billboard's Blues Albums Top 10 list, where it sits currently at number 10. Reviewers are giving Katie high marks for her powerful mix of blues and rock. We're super happy to have you here.
Thanks.
Guitar in hand. It's going to be very exciting. Tell us about the past week, Katie, since the album's release. What's it been like?
It's been a whirlwind. In fact, I'm riding off like 2 hours of sleep right now.
Mm-hmm.
gosh, you know, last Friday I got this magical email from the guys over at Billboard charting headquarters.
And oh, they tell you ahead of time?
Well, they said, this is what drove me crazy. They said, so you might be charting on the Blues Albums chart and the Heat Seekers Pacific chart. So we need to verify your UPC code. And I was like, what? I might on both charts?
Right.
I didn't expect that. I had a goal to get on the Heat Seekers chart with my pre-sales campaign I ran. And everybody was so supportive buying it and stuff. So anyway, I had to wait for like 4 days because the charts didn't come out till Tuesday to find out. So Tuesday morning at 6 a.m, I'm going on the computer
just
trying
yesterday,
to,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going on the computer trying to figure out how to find this chart because it's not the main chart. So you have to kind of dig a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband finally comes up to me and he shoves a phone screen in front of my face. He says, Katie, I just Googled it. Here you are. You're number 10. I said, what?
Oh, my gosh. Is that like something you've just been dreaming of?
Yes, of course.
Ever.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Let's hear a bit from this charting album right now so we can all get a taste of what the studio sound is like. Then we'll hear from you live in just a little bit. Tell us about I Don't Sing For You.
Yeah, it's just about the freedom of finally not singing about an ex-boyfriend, not caring about them being a muse anymore.
Right. Okay, let's hear it. That's your studio sound right there, and it's not just you, but you were telling me that that is you on the piano?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Who else is helping contribute?
Yeah, so Brett von Rechtfertig is on the lead guitar part there, and we've got Zach Proteau on bass, Neil Campisano on drums, and I was able to get my friend Scott Berlin of SBL as a harmony vocalist on there, too.
Nice.
So it was really fun.
So you're charting on the blues albums, but how do you describe your sound?
It's more blues Americana. I'm definitely not straight ahead blues. I'm inspired by so many people from jazz to even classical to everything. But blues has obviously become a pretty wide term. So, hey, right. I'll take it. If they're putting it on that chart, great.
You could be on the pop dance singles and you wouldn't care, right?
Yeah.
It's on there. What was your inspiration for this album?
It's a collection of different stories. Honestly, I was happy to just do it at all because I had two babies in a row pretty recently. And, the demands of motherhood made it a little difficult to practice at all, write at all. So what happened was my love for music in general and for songwriting and playing just one note, for crying out loud, just increased exponentially because I began to appreciate the time that I did have. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a second chance at life or something. That's what it feels like to me right now.
Nice. We all want those.
Yeah.
I meant to ask you before you got in here, where are you from?
Originally, I grew up in Concord.
The East Bay. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and then lived there for 20-something years, and then I lived in Marin County for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years.
I grew up there.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I lived in Mill Valley.
Uh-huh, nice.
And then I've been in the Sacramento area for about 10 years.
So we can claim you.
Yes. Yeah.
Is what I'm getting at. I guess, yeah. Okay, so since we're claiming you, we'll say Sacramento's very own Katie Nipp is going to perform live for us now. So I'll give you a second to get into that position. And while you're doing that, I want to ask you, do you prefer studio sessions or performing live?
I like performing live the most because when you record, it just feels like you have this pressure to be perfect. You know,
I would think it would be reversed, that you need to be perfect because it's one chance on stage, but you can re-record something in the studio.
Yeah, but I love the communication on stage. I love being able to goof around with the audience and tell them funny stories and have that energy exchange. You know, when you're by yourself in the studio, it's hard to get pumped up, you know?
Yeah, no, I understand that. So what are we going to hear?
This is a song called Letters, and I figure since Veterans Day was just a few days ago, this is written about a military couple where one of them has post-traumatic stress disorder, and they're just trying to keep the faith in their marriage.
Terrific. Let's hear it.
Okay. Saw you drinking your dinner and I saw you standing on the edge and I know that we belong together. So sitting in your gutter pointing high, saw you standing on your highest mountain, and I know we still need time. We belong together.
Gonna be fine. but not for us.
Billboard Top 10 artist Katie Knipp, new album Take It With You, released just 1 week ago. She has an album release show. Find details at capradio.org. That's Insight for today. Back with another live show tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.